Mr. Alfred Apubar is from the Midwest of the area which we have discussed. I think you're now knowledgeable enough to know that area and will be the first speaker. Will speak, and he has materials which he'll distribute to you, some of which you can keep, some of which you'll have to share with others because there aren't enough to go all the way around, and he can explain a little bit more to you as we get to that point. He'll be the first one on the program, and he'll explain the position of the Nigerian government as it relates to the situation which we've been discussing and working with in this class under the title of Nigerian Biafran Tragedy. So without taking any more of his time, we will start with Mr. Apubar.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bushman. Let me say that I wish I didn't have to come here tonight. I wish that this course, of which my talk is a part, didn't have to be given. I wish that for many reasons. It's very obvious, I'm sure, if you empathize with me and put yourself in my position, you'll see that it's an unpleasant thing to talk about the disintegration and tragic events of one's country. I grew up in Nigeria at a time when it was a very exciting country to live in. At a time when, even though we had problems, one could still talk with one's fellow countrymen. I was born in northern Nigeria, of parents who came from the Midwest part of Nigeria, who had gone to the north to work. The schools I went to were missionary schools, and most of my friends, my playmates, were from other parts of Nigeria. We moved around a lot because my father worked for the Nigerian Railways. We moved around to the east. I went to school. In fact, I first started school in eastern Nigeria. We moved around to the west and the north again. I went to secondary school in the Midwest. I say all this to give you something of a feeling of the kind of a country it was at a time when I was growing up. It's not easy to forget that kind of thing. Some people think that the tragedy of Nigeria is the fact that people are dying every day and that people have died. I think that's tragic. I think so very much. But I think that perhaps the basic tragedy is that it became inevitable for us to settle our internal differences without resorting to civil war, which is a very wasteful war. Civil war, as you know, is wasteful of human lives, is wasteful of energy, and it's wasteful of that kind of goodwill on which a country is built. So I'm sorry. I wish I didn't have to come here. I wish I didn't have to come here. I wish there hadn't been a civil war in Nigeria. Or if I had to come here and talk to you about Nigeria, I hope it would have been to talk about progress. But I've come here not only because I remember the Nigeria in which I grew up, but because I think that we have learned something from our recent experience. I come here because I have hope in the future of Nigeria. I have a daughter. I'd like her to grow up. She's 2 years old. I'd like her to grow up in a Nigeria where the kinds of things which we have seen recently don't exist. It is for her. For children like her who have died, children who will not know the future, it's because of those people that I've come. I think also a second reason I've come is because of the irresponsibility of the international community. If the international community were more responsible, if it were more responsive, if it were more informed, if it had taken the trouble to be informed, if it had created the kinds of people who could report responsibly on events in the world, perhaps you would not have needed this course. And so I've come here for those two reasons, and others besides. Let me say straight away that in no way do I officially represent the federal government of Nigeria. I am not in government employ. I'm a private citizen, a concerned private citizen. But I think I know enough of what the federal government is trying to do. I think I'm acquainted enough with its pronouncements and its plans for the future that the things I say will not be too deviant from what the federal government of Nigeria believes in. I think also that I belong to a growing and increasing group of educated Nigerians who are concerned, genuinely concerned about their country and its future and want to do something about it. My colleagues, fellow previous lecturers on this course, have probably given you the background to the situation in Nigeria from their own point of view, from the point of view of their academic specialization and their experience. I hear you've had something about the history of Nigeria. But I think that for us to understand what went on and what is going on, some kind of a historical perspective and background is necessary. I'm going to try and do it fairly quickly, but I think it's an important part of the things I have to say. I also want to make a general comment on why people who live in communities do the things they do. I think that lay people, and I include myself in this, often think that there is an inexorable external reality which is the same for every person, and that everybody acts from the same kind of reality. Let me say that if you have a large community, even if you have a small community, no two people see things the same way. That people's actions are colored very, very strongly by their interpretation of events. I say this because I think that in the Nigerian situation, the way people have interpreted the coming together of many things is responsible for some kinds of actions that have taken place. Unless we understand this, unless we try to empathize with people who were acting under certain kinds of pressure, I think all our so-called concern would be really irresponsible. It is impossible to come to a realization of why people do things unless we try and put ourselves in their place. Of course, when we've done that, we can still say, we think you're right, we think you're wrong, or we think your action was misguided. What I'm saying is that first and foremost, that attempt to empathize with another person, with another group of people, is important. You've been told that Nigeria was created by the British. You've been told that it brought together, or the British brought together in Nigeria, diverse peoples, people with different cultures and backgrounds. You've been told that these people had different religions and different languages. You've been told that there was a history of uneasy relationship among those people. This is all true, by and large. This is all true. But I think that after 50 years or so of working together, sometimes against their will, these peoples were beginning to identify, perhaps not in large numbers, but those who had vision were beginning to identify with this entity. When popular politics came into Nigeria, it became inevitable, of course, that politicians, being the kinds of creatures they would want to use all means at their disposal to gain power. One of the easiest means, given the kind of composition of the country, was divisive, particularistic politics. I think that this is quite true of all of our leaders. Well, we did have a popular, so-called popular civilian government, popularly elected, one man, one vote, by and large. And the events of January 15th, 1966, are now history, a military coup. Military coup that came as a result of the corruption, the total irrelevance, and the repressiveness of the civilian government. It was the action of the military, which was greeted with a great deal of relief by people in Nigeria, because, as I say, the federal government was beginning to become repressive. It was corrupt, but people didn't seem to mind corruption. But repression, physical repression, that people minded. And lots of people were delighted when the civilian government was removed by the military. I was back in Nigeria myself in April and May of 66. At that time, the euphoria was still there. There was still a great deal of delight. I was able to travel every part of Nigeria to every capital of Nigeria. That was the kind of assignment which I was involved in. Fortunately, it gave me a chance to see my country at a time, 3 months after the first military coup. And there was a great deal of hope. And as I say, the euphoria was still there. But at that time, even then, one could begin to see that certain kinds of relationship between different parts of the country were leading to doom. In May of 1966, Major General Agu Iranzi, who, because of the January 15, 1966 military coup, was made commander of the Nigerian army, proclaimed a centralization of the services of the country. Let me say that when the first coup happened, the interpretation then was that this was an act of liberation for the civilian population. But after the civilian population had a chance to look at the pattern of killings, of who died and who didn't, both within the military and the civilian population, it became quite clear to many people that the killings had not been accidental. If they were accidental, they were terribly unfortunate. By which I mean that it seemed as if more non-Igbos of importance died than Igbos of importance. This is the way it looked at the time. Now, you might say this is chance. If it's chance, it's very unfortunate. And I think perhaps it was irresponsible of whoever led the coup not to eliminate all the political leaders, because it gave the impression. It was easy then for somebody to plant a rumor and say, aha, what was happening was they were trying to seize power. This is the way people perceived the issues. When an Igbo man became leader of the federal government after this coup, I don't think many people were angry or cared. But then he, in his position, took actions which looked, again, from my point of view, irresponsible. Because of these actions, the military, which was composed mostly of Northerners, became restive, because it was felt that the initial coup had been betrayed, that what started off to be a liberation from corrupt politicians was being converted into domination by potentially corrupt and repressive military people. Supported, in this case, by his own ethnic group. And so, on May 29, 1966, there was a military uprising in northern Nigeria. That was followed 2 months later by what some people have called a counter-coup, another action within the military itself, which brought over new leadership. The leadership this time devolved on Yakubu Gawan, a young northerner, a non-Hausa. I have records that show that Yakubu Gawan was persuaded under great pressure to accept leadership. He had not participated in this so-called counter-coup which removed Iranzi. He was persuaded under great pressure to accept power. All the military leaders who were ahead of him in hierarchy could not assume power at that point. And they persuaded him, even though he was not really next in command, to accept the position of head of the military government. I have records to show this, and the Aburi conference, which I'm going to be talking about earlier, in its transcript, full transcript, emphasizes this point over and over and over again, that he was persuaded to assume power. Gawan's first action was to call together a conference to stem the tide of the difficulties that we have received in Nigeria, a conference to look also at the constitutional position to try and bring some kind of rationality to the governing of Nigeria. This conference was called for sometime in September, but long before the conference itself, on September 11th, we heard reports of an explosion near the Federal Palace Hotel, which is one of the biggest hotels in Lagos. And when the root cause of that explosion was traced, it was traced to an Igbo civilian who was high up in association with the military governor of the East. Let me say at this point that the military governor of the East, Colonel Juku, was thoroughly dissatisfied with the fact that Yakubu Gawan was made head of state after General Ironsi. He argued at that point that it was a matter of military principle, that he didn't think Gawan was next in command and he shouldn't have been made head of state. This was his argument. But he also took actions that gave the impression that the reason he was dissatisfied was that one of his own ethnic group members was no longer in command. After this explosion that took place in the Federal Palace Hotel on the eve of the Constitutional Conference, there was a broadcast over foreign radio stations, notably the radio station of the neighboring country of Dahomey, stating that northerners in the eastern part of Nigeria had been attacked and killed. This was between the 20th and the 28th of September. The conference was meeting about this time. And this broadcast was repeated over northern Nigeria radio. And the civilian population immediately broke loose. On the 29th, there was what I would describe as a massacre of people of Eastern origin, Southern origin, in fact. Anybody who was not regarded as Northern was attacked. Well, many non-Northerners died in this attack. But let it also be said for the record that we have information that lots of non-Northerners, lots of Southerners, lots of Easterners were hidden and saved from the anger of the mobs by their northern friends. There are documented reports of personal heroism by northerners who took their own eastern or southern friends, because at this time there wasn't much of a distinction. They took friends, drove them hundreds of miles across the border so they could be safe. There are many, many instances documented by people who have returned to Lansing, people who were in Nigeria at that time. So I say this to balance the record and also to begin to question this whole business of genocide, which is one of the words that has become current in this issue. All around this time, as the conference was going on, there were explosions in various parts of Nigeria, explosions of little bombs, and usually traced to Easterners. Now, this is the time at which, in fact, no hostilities had been called. We were still one country. But these actions were being taken by people from one part of the country. On October the 3rd, that's a few days after Easterners had been killed in northern Nigeria, General Gawan went on radio and spoke to the country. He also spoke to the conference. And I say, I'm going to read here what he said, because I think it characterizes the man and the spirit of the time. Gentlemen, I will tell you this. Certainly there has been a damage. I think that is what we never seem to admit when there is something like that. There is a damage, and I am very, very sorry about it. He's talking now about the people who were killed in the North. I regret it, and I am doing everything I can. As I said, for God's sake, don't lose hope. If we are alive and if we are determined, we can get this country back into its proper shape. I am determined to do that, even if it means my life. I give you my word for it. To our Eastern friends, for God's sake, please don't lose hope. Let us try and see what we can do to mend what has happened. Give me a chance, and I'm quite convinced I will be able to do something very shortly. Here was a man speaking from his heart. He wasn't speaking from notes, and this is the way he felt. This was on October the 3rd, 1966. Shortly thereafter, when the conference was over, non-Easterners in the East were asked by the Eastern government to leave. I skip over a number of months and come to the Abori conference in Ghana on January the 4th through the 5th, 1967. The conference was to decide the future course of Nigeria, to decide what kinds of constitutional arrangements would be engaged in. And it came out with a resolution in which it advocated a strong central government. There had been tensions on this score at the conference. Again, we have in our library here at Michigan State full transcripts of the proceedings of the Abori conference. I was just looking at them this afternoon. There were tensions on this issue. And some states, at some stages, wanted to have weak regional governments, the feeling being that perhaps then they could control their own affairs. But by the end of the conference, it was pretty clear that what was decided upon was a strong central government. When the Eastern delegation got back, there was a great deal of furore. There had been at the conference dissatisfaction on the part of the Eastern delegation, and one could see from their behavior after the conference that they were still dissatisfied. Towards the end of January, Mr. Ojukwu decided to impound about $500,000 worth of produce which belonged to the Northern Nigeria Marketing Board. Shortly thereafter, he also impounded one-third of the stock of the Nigerian Railway Corporation, which was a federal corporation. This included 115 oil tankers. Again, we're talking now at a time when we were still one government. We were still supposed to be, technically, we were one country, as we still are today. But at least everybody then said, everybody subscribed to the fact at that time that we were one country. At the moment, of course, some people say we are not one country. But this is months before secession. I think it's important to notice this fact. Also, about the same time, Mr. Ojukwu obstructed the transportation of goods from Nigeria to friendly African countries, Chad and Cameroon. These were goods that had to pass through his territory to go to these friendly African countries who were our neighbors. He refused to have these goods pass through his territory. Again, this was in January of 1967, months before secession. In March of 1967, he proposed an edict in which he was going to have all federal government monies which were in the East paid into the Eastern Treasury. These were funds which belonged to the federal government but were located in the Eastern region. He had them paid into his own government coffers. In April of 1967, an airplane belonging to the Nigerian Airways, which was a federal concern, was seized at Port Harcourt, which was a port in eastern Nigeria. About a week later, on April the 13th, a plane belonging to the Nigerian Airways was hijacked by some Igbo people who, there's documentation for, were acting under orders from the eastern government. A plane was hijacked from Benin, the port of the Midwest, the airport of the Midwest, and taken to Enugu, which was then capital of the eastern region. On May 6th, in a personal discussion with Chief Obafemi Awolowo, who was sent as a civilian of high esteem, a former leader of Nigeria in the days of civilian rule, in a personal discussion with Chief Awolowo, who had been sent as leader of a peace delegation, Mr. Ojukwu said this about the rest of Nigeria and his relationship. He said, this was again May 1967, about 3 weeks before secession. I started off this struggle in July 1966 with 120 rifles to defend the integrity of the East. I took my stand knowing fully well that by doing so, whilst carving my name in history, I was signing also my death warrant. Quietly, I built. If you do not know it, I am proud, and my officers are proud, that here in the East, we possess the biggest army in Black Africa. I am no longer speaking as an underdog. I am speaking from a position of power. On the specific question of whether there is a possibility of contact with the North, the answer is on the battlefield. Now, this was 3 weeks before he actually declared secession. I say this because it seems to me that the building of military strength is not something you do overnight. It's something that comes as a result of calculated planning. And those who have said that the federal government's action led to secession in 2 days and led to the massive buildup had better think again. It seems to me that the evidence I'm giving points to a different kind of interpretation. Now, on May the 27th, 1967, the federal government promulgated a decree that led to the creation of 12 states in Nigeria as a way of bringing some kind of political stability into the country. How many minutes have I got?
You have 5 minutes.
5 minutes, that's what my reckoning says, 5 minutes, fine. 3 days later, perhaps a reaction to the creation of 12 states, because in the creation of 12 states, an East Central State was created, which included all of the Igbo heartland. Perhaps as a reaction to this, but perhaps for other kinds of reasons, Mr. Ojukwu declared secession. This was 3 days after the federal government had promulgated the creation of 12 states as a way to, as a beginning to bring in some peace into Nigeria. Following this action, in June of 1967, there were explosions and bombings in Lagos and other parts of Nigeria by Ojukwu's men. These explosions harmed national resources and innocent civilians. Again, war had not been declared at this stage. In July of 1967, on the 6th of July, the lines of battle were drawn. The federal government moved towards the borders of the East, and Ojukwu's men moved towards the northern border of Nigeria. And hostilities began that day. The federal government claims that Ojukwu's men shot at federal troops who had no recourse but to retaliate. The other side says the federal government instigated the fighting. This is one of those things where perhaps my word is as good as yours. But this is the way things were. By August 1967, there were bombings all over the place. Let this be said also for the record, that people keep saying the federal government has amassed arms. Let it be said that the first bombings were by Ojukwu. I remember in the Western press when Ojukwu bought 2 B-26 bombers and bombed parts of Lagos, and civilians were injured and killed. There was a great deal of talk of the enterprising spirit of the Igbo man, which made it possible for him to go and buy bombs and bomb people. Ojukwu was the first person to introduce bombing into the situation. It was a result of this that many parts of Nigeria became quite frantic. What do we do for our safety? When a man bombs us, what do we do? The feelings, which became quite high after this, are traceable to this kind of event. Most of Nigeria at this time was, you might say, neutral. I'm talking of the civilian population. Most of it was neutral, didn't take sides. But when innocent civilians in Lagos and in the Midwest, which was on the 13th of August, overrun by Ojukwu's troops, civilians were deployed of their means of livelihood and badly and shabbily treated. It was after this kind of confrontation with Ojukwu's men that the rest of Nigeria began to say, we'll have to do something about taking care of ourselves. I think my time is about up. I'll just sum up very briefly a number of general statements. The talk of genocide is completely unfounded, if I understand what the word genocide means in English. There's been no systematic planned attempt to either hate or liquidate or eliminate the Igbo. This is totally false. The federal government for a long time did not believe in spreading any kinds of rumor or information both within Nigeria and outside of Nigeria. The other side, of course, for its own reasons, had a great deal of propaganda activity going on. And this is the reason I think that most people have tended to hear one side of the case. Currently, the federal government, in very responsible terms, is planning what it calls a program of reconstruction. I've seen some of these plans, I've read about them, I've talked to people involved with them, and I believe that genuinely, as soon as the military part of the war is over, the federal government is going to undertake its responsibility of reconstructing Nigeria and building for the future of what will be a great country in Africa. My time is up, and thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, at this time we will have the presentation by Dr. Umba Zuku, who will present the views as held by the group known as Biafrans. Umba?
Thank you, Dr. Bushman. Let me say also that I am not a Biafran government representative, and what I'm going to say is based entirely on what I experienced when I grew up in Nigeria and school there, and when the trouble started in Nigeria before I came to this country 2 years ago. I had planned a method of approach, which to a large extent I'm going to have to abandon so as to touch on a few points my colleague here has raised. It seems to me, to begin with, that he's asking us, in this case, to forget and refuse to accept everything that the correspondents from all over the world have written on this war, but to accept what his government has put out as their own side of the case and accept this as authentic. Well, the choice is yours. I'm not going to decide for you. I'm going to attempt to give you, as precisely as I can, the side of the story as given by Biafrans. This may not be all, but I think it will give you an insight into what has happened in that part of the world. And just now, I am speaking as a Biafran. And I want you to bear this in mind throughout. Throughout this course, you have heard a number of things about Nigeria as it was before the crisis, the historical, economic, and cultural aspects of the whole question. And I would like also to mention, just for the correct perspective, a few historical events that to me seem important in understanding the whole situation. I don't think there's any question about the creation of Nigeria by Britain. This is accepted. Nigeria was created by Britain. Up till 1914, Nigeria was being administered as two separate entities, northern provinces and southern provinces, and the amalgamation only came in 1914. It's significant that in the following 50 years, Nigerians never achieved what we would like to believe is a sense of belonging to the same country. This was completely lacking. Whether this was an inherent quality of the Nigerians or something that was implanted in their minds by the colonial masters is a question I won't attempt to answer at all. But in the late 40s, up to the early 50s, people were still saying that the amalgamation of Nigeria was a mistake. And here I quote the Sadaona Osokoto, Premier of Northern Nigeria. He He called the amalgamation of Nigeria in 1914 a mistake that has come to light. Even the honored Prime Minister of Nigeria, Abubakar Tafawa Balewa, still talked in terms of Northern Nigeria being essentially a different part of what we knew as Nigeria. And this was in 1947 in the House of Representatives, which is the equivalent of your House of, what do you call it here? House of Representatives, yeah, usual thing. So that even in the 40s, Nigerians had not learned that they were Nigerians first and foremost. And this in spite of the fact that in the early 40s, political parties had been formed, and these political parties had sought to bring this awareness to the Nigerians, to realize that they were Nigerians at that time and had a right to separate existence from the British. And one of the foremost parties that did demand this kind of dissociation from the British government was the National Council of Nigeria and the Cameroons, that was formed in 1944 as a result of student demand. Its first chairman was a Yoruba man. Its first secretary was an Igbo man, Azikiwe, which all of you know. And this party was foremost in demanding some sort of autonomy for Nigerians. And let me say that Southerners at that time accepted this party as representing the views of progressive, in quotes, Nigerians, so that it had membership in all areas of Nigeria. And anyone at all who wanted to have a say in the politics of the country had to join the only party that did exist at that time. Now, the Igbos have been accused of all sorts of things. I would like to mention that this party was embraced by most Igbos. I say most because eventually, when they did have other parties, Igbos, true to their sense of self-determination in everything, thinking for themselves, did join other parties. But because of the move of the South, spearheaded by Igbos, in 1945 in northern Nigeria, Igbos were killed in Jos for no good reason whatsoever, and the British were still in Nigeria. 1950, a new political party had been formed in the West, which preached tribalism for the first time in Nigerian politics. It was this party that reminded Westerners that there were Westerners, and so the West should belong to Westerners, East to the Easterners, and North to the Northerners. It was on this kind of slogan that that party won the election into the Western House of Assembly. And I venture to say that it was this kind of thing that reminded the Northerners, more than any other thing, that in fact the North did belong to Northerners. And we're not surprised that soon after this, the North adopted the same policy of North for Northerners, changing their civil service code to the extent that if you had to get a job in Northern Nigeria, you had to be a Northern Nigerian first. If you were not that, then you had to be a Britisher. If you were not that, then you had to be a Muslim from any other part of the world. Failing to get any of these people, the North then considered fellow Nigerians for employment in the Northern Public Service and on contract. Now, I mention these things because I want to establish one thing, that in spite of the fact that Nigeria had been created in 1914 as one country, we never attained that height of agreeing in ourselves that we actually belong to one country. We were still divided, and it was this division that gave rise to most of the things that happened hereafter. All right, I have a handout here. I'm not going to touch on many other things in this historical aspect because I think you can read the synopsis as I have it in the handout. But the crisis in Nigeria had gone on. Corruption, and we agree there was just too much corruption in Nigeria to the extent that even with your qualification, you could not get a job. For professionally trained people, this was frustrating. For non-trained people, it was even worse. And so, like my colleague, I would say, when the January coup occurred, it was a popular coup. 1 week after the coup, I traveled everywhere in northern Nigeria. And I could repeat to you these statements being made by northern Nigerians. Now, why did they change? Why did they eventually turn around and say this was an Igbo coup? He has suggested to you, because our analysis of the people who were killed shows you that more non-Igbos were killed. Well, I'm happy it did say more non-Igbos, not just that every person killed was a non-Igbo. But he puts the blame on the leader of the coup. Now, he couldn't have been omnipresent. If he was leading a coup in one sector and he had lieutenants in other areas that were supposed to fulfill their part, I don't think it would be physically possible for him to be present in every spot. So if there was a failure in the coup, and we know that military officers fled the country rather than carry out their own assignments, and the Nigerians know it. It was in every paper. Anyway, the coup came and was popular. It was hailed by everybody, including Dr. Koya Aripo, who himself is a Biafran but chooses to call himself a Nigerian. While speaking to the American Chamber of Commerce here in America, he called it a spontaneous act of will by the people, for the people. Koya Aripo, he did at that time. All right, but what happened? How did it eventually dawn on people that this was an Igbo coup, in quotes? A number of professors in the University of the North went around the students of Northern origin and tried to convince them with the figures that we are being given this evening that more Northerners were killed. Therefore, the intention must have been to kill Northerners. If they'll give you the records too, since they must have them, they'll show you that the Nigerian government reacted to the May killings. The Nigerian military government reacted to the May killings by expelling two of these professors. Now, if they had not done anything wrong, perhaps they would not have been expelled. But the other aspect of the coup and the immediate events that followed it, I would like to touch on, is the role Major General Agui Ironsi, himself an Igbo, was supposed to have played. Up till today, there are people who accuse him of having led the coup. But they would not tell you that for several days after January 15, Ironsi, with the help of loyal Nigerian soldiers, including Igbos, was fighting against the people who staged the coup. And eventually, by coercion, by promises, by force of arms, he did get the rebels to lay down their arms. Now, we are calling them rebels now. At that time, we did call them heroes. Well, let's call them rebels now, just to be in context. They laid down their arms with a number of promises, what he was going to do. They made it clear what their intention was when this coup was staged. And it was only on the basis that the government that was going to be formed would carry out the intentions that the rebels agreed to lay down arms. The government of Nigeria was handed over to Agui Ironsi by the remaining members of parliament. There was a ceremony for it. It was something done voluntarily when once they knew that they were not going to be able to run the government. Now, Ironsi is accused of many things, amongst which is that he proceeded to appoint his fellow countrymen, his people from the same ethnic group with him to head departments. I have drawn a table in the handout which I'm going to give you, which gives you figures on the representation of the different sectors of Nigeria in the supreme military, government, and council. I'm of the totals. Let me just give you totals. We had 19 people represented in the Supreme Military Council, Federal Executive Council, heads of federal public service, and heads of federal corporations and institutions. West and Lagos had 23. Midwest, there were 10. The East had 11. And expatriates were 3. This constituted the most important post of our government under Gui Irunsi. Now, comparing the figures of Midwest, East, and North, with populations at that time estimated at, let's assume the Northern population was what it was, 29 million, and the West about 10, and Midwest just 2.5, and the East about 12 at that time. These figures could hardly represent proportional allocations of heads of department or membership of Supreme Military Council. With the North, 29 million people, they had only 19. Midwest, with 2.5 million people, had 10 representatives. So it sort of amuses me that a Midwesterner can sit here and say, Irunsi did this. Because if anything, he favored the Midwest. But that's just one point. One other factor which Nigerians glory in telling the world is that Irunsi took actions. Irunsi took actions. But now, when they want to talk of Gowon, they'll tell you the Federal Military Council took actions. They will not tell you that Irunsi did not take any of these actions without the approval of the Supreme Military Council, of which the North had 2 representatives, West and Lagos 3, Midwest 1, East 2. Supreme Military Council. Osman Katsina, Lieutenant Colonel Osman Katsina, I don't know what they call him, I think they have promoted him of recent, was a member of this council. Gowon himself was a member of this council, the enlarged council. They took the decisions. But it suits their purpose to lay the blame entirely on Agui Irunsi simply because he was an Igbo. All right, then in May, the Supreme Military Council decided to issue an edict, a decree, usually called the ones issued from Lagos decrees. They issued a decree that sought to unify the country in the sense that the people who actually thought of Nigeria as Nigeria wanted it. They wanted a unified public service where it would be possible for people to work anywhere in Nigeria, irrespective of their region of origin. But of course, this didn't suit the Northerners. And very quickly, they spread the rumor that they wanted unification to make it possible for the Igbos to take over all the important posts in Nigeria. Well, you just think about this a little bit. If they had a unified public service with every person available, every person qualified to go into the public service, having only one source to which he could apply, and being eligible for transfer to any other part of the country, in what way would you tell a qualified northerner, no, you are not taken, this easterner must come in? But this was the thing they gave out, that if they unified the public service, northerners could not get jobs, easterners would take all the jobs. And we are told that this decree was the immediate cause of the May killings. Spontaneously, on a Sunday morning, as people were worshiping in churches in several cities of the North, civilians were killed in churches, in their homes, some markets operated on Sundays, and in markets, they did kill them. This was May. And quite a few people decided that they were going to leave the north and return to eastern Nigeria in particular. The military governor of the east, Lieutenant Colonel Ojukwu, made a statement on May the 30th asking Nigerians, because he called every one of us Nigerians, to return to their jobs, and this was their country, and they were here to stay. He promised that the Supreme Military Government was going to take immediate action against those who caused all the trouble. And so people who had packed their things to come back stayed back. Those who had already left returned to the north. This was in May. Then July 29. The Hausas were on the rampage again. This time we are told it was a mutiny within the army. But eyewitness accounts will tell you that Nigerian armed officers, people in the armed forces of Nigeria, participated in the killings on July 29. Now, how did this happen? Because the opposition to the unification decree, decree number 34, as they know it in Nigeria, had increased in the north. Irosi decided he was going to consult with the leaders of the north, east, west, and midwest. So he summoned a meeting of all the leaders in Ibadan. He addressed this meeting on the 20th. Early in the morning, on the 29th, he was abducted by Nigerian military officers, led by Gowon. Now we are told he didn't take part in it. He was killed. His host, the military governor of Western Nigeria, with whom he stayed, was also kidnapped and killed. Now the Nigerian military officers who took this action did not inform the nation about the fate of the leader of government. And this was the reason the military governor of eastern Nigeria decided that until he knew what happened to the one everyone had accepted as the leader of government, he was not in the mood to recognize any other person. And assuming that the leader of government had been killed or was missing, there were other people who were qualified to take his place. And we had to know, he demanded, why these people were not going to take their place. Anyway, not long after that one, the one everyone was hoping was going to be able to take over, to step into the shoes of his immediate superior, Ogundigbe, was already on his way to England, flying out of the country. And while he was on a Nigerian yacht leaving the Lagos Airport, he was waving to Nigerians saying no cause for alarm. At a time when 3,000 people had been killed in the north, he said no cause for alarm, and for a while, no one knew what his fate was going to be. Eventually, of course, when Gowon settled down, he made him commissioner for Nigeria in London, rather than having him his immediate superior. This was July 29. Gowon, we are told, was forced to accept the post. Sure, he would be forced to accept the post because he knew he wasn't the right person to be there. But assuming that even he was forced to take over the mantles of government, what was his first statement? August 1, his first statement to the nation was that there was no basis for unity. There was no basis for unity. August 1, 1966, and this was the man who had taken over government for the first time, the man who was forced. We hear the thing that comes from his mind that wasn't written, that he had to read, about people not being despondent and all the rest of it. But he had told us already that there was no basis for unity and that he was going to take action. What action did he take? We shall know what action he took when we hear that on September 29, while an ad hoc constitutional conference was meeting, a meeting that he summoned himself, Northerners went on the rampage this time and killed 30,000 people. They ask us, how do we know the figures? When you know that every family in Biafra was affected by the killings in the north, then you won't find it difficult whatsoever to imagine that at least 30,000 people had been killed. All right. But we did have this, he did summon this, August 8 to 9, they had a meeting that was supposed to work out a basis for further association in Nigeria. And he told this meeting that they were to rule out a unitary government and they were to rule out a breakup of the Nigerian Federation. This meeting recommended that all Nigerian soldiers should be returned to their own regions of origin so as to reduce the friction. Because at this time, you had Hausa soldiers in eastern Nigeria, Igbo soldiers who hadn't been killed in west and midwest and Lagos and north. And they thought the best thing to do would be to reduce the friction by returning these people to their homes until they worked out a basis of association. This conference did recommend returning the soldiers to their regions and having some sort of loose government until matters were patched up. What was Gowon's response to this? He immediately ordered the occupation of Western Nigeria by Northern soldiers. They should tell you this. Now, what was his intention? Why did he want to do this? But he did it. However, communication continued to exist between him and Lieutenant Colonel Ojukwu, Lieutenant Colonel Ejo of the Midwest, and Katsina of the North, and the new man in the West. So they agreed on this ad hoc constitutional conference, and they started meeting in September. The memorandum submitted by Northern Nigeria, the first memorandum submitted by Northern Nigeria, made it clear that they would not favor anything other than a confederation. They also demanded a secession clause in the constitution making it possible for any region that was dissatisfied to secede from the rest of Nigeria. When this met with immediate acceptance by every other delegation except the Midwest, oh, they thought there must be a catch in this. They procured an adjournment of the meeting, and when the meeting reconvened, September 22, Northern Nigeria delegation submitted a second memorandum, now demanding a strong federal government with a strong center and weak regions. They were now asking for a unitary government, the very thing the Supreme Military Council had asked for and decreed in Decree Number 34, and for which Agui Yironsi and Lieutenant Colonel Fajui, the military governor of the Western region, had been killed in July. Now the Northern delegation wanted it. Well, when discussions continued, they made their recommendations, which amounted to a sort of loose federation, loose association, at least for a specified time, to give people chance to forget things. Gowon replied to this in November by unilaterally dismissing the committee. They were no longer to meet. Then later on, he announced that he was going to issue a constitution for the country, all on his own, without consultation with anybody. By the way, I jump one thing. In his October speech, which we have heard of, they should have also told us that Gowon, in that same speech, while he was imploring the Northerners to keep calm, he did remind them that once more Allah meaning God, in his mercy, had given the government of Nigeria back into the hands of yet another Northerner. This was October 3. And this was a man who, at the same time, was asking his fellow countrymen to keep calm. You talk of explosions. If you killed my brother and I was still in Kano, I would want to kill you. It doesn't matter what I use. And I think it would be wrong for you to, unless you can prove it, to say categorically that the government has caused it. All right, Aburi. Aburi had his, they had their meetings in Aburi and took a number of decisions. Federal government was to give aid to displaced Easterners, federal government was to pay the federal employees who had returned to the East. All this they refused to do when they came back from Aburi. The reports are there. I mean, even the recording is there. I mean, no one can deceive you. If you have time, go and read it. Well, they failed to do this. And when the burden of caring for these refugees had become unbearable to the Eastern Nigeria government, they had to pass what we call the survival edicts, which made it possible for the government to collect tax that was due the federal government and keep within Eastern Nigeria in order to take this responsibility. March 31st, when Nigeria ended its financial year, they made allocations to every other government but that of Eastern Nigeria. There was no allocation to run the government of Eastern Nigeria for the next year, in spite of the fact that they had not met their responsibilities. And therefore, the Eastern Nigeria government called on the leaders of thought who had their meeting and decided on May 27 to ask the Eastern Nigeria military government at that time to take measures to declare Eastern Nigeria a sovereign and independent Republic of Biafra. This they did on May the 30th after Gowon had wanted to forestall this by creating his so-called 12 states. July 6, Nigeria invaded Eastern Nigeria.